Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. Our guest today is Aaron Bregman, Senior Teaching Fellow at King's College London, and the author of Cursed Victory, A History of Israel and the Occupied Territories. Aaron knows of what he speaks. He served in the Israeli army for 6 years, taking part in the 1982 Lebanon War, and he reached the rank of major. Welcome, Aaron. Thank you for joining us. I just want to ask you a general question. Where do you think we are concerning the conflict in Gaza at the moment?
Not in a good place. From an Israeli point of view, so far they've failed to achieve their two objectives. Objective number one was to topple Hamas, to uproot them. This is not going to be achieved. And the Israelis have always failed so far to achieve aim number two, which is to release the hostages. From a Palestinian point of view, it is also not good because the Gaza Strip is not in a good place. I believe that when we reach the end of this conflict, the number of people killed there will probably reach 40,000. 8,000 people can't be found. They are under the rubble. 70% of those killed are women and children. So it's not good.
Talking from a military point of view, you obviously have military experience. Do you think there was another way of doing this, of fighting this war, that could have led to fewer casualties, but been just as successful for Israel?
One of the main considerations of Israel when they embarked on this operation was to keep the number of casualties on the Israeli side as low as possible. Therefore, the soldiers who invaded the Gaza Strip were just surrounded themselves with fire, and they moved very slowly. And the bombs which were dropped from the air, very big bombs, caused massive destruction to structures, houses in the Gaza Strip, and they also caused many casualties. So it was the Israeli concern about Israeli casualties that led them to use this tactic, which was a very destructive Gaza Strip.
Aaron, you've written so eloquently about how in Israeli history, military victories on the battlefield have often had a very complicated political legacy. Do you see the conflict in Gaza following some of that pattern?
I want to qualify what you've just said, Alistair, because there is no Israeli victory there. There will not be Israeli victory in the Gaza Strip. The Israelis failed three times. They failed to predict that an attack is coming, that is before the 7th of October, then they failed to respond properly. And the third time when they failed was to achieve their military aims, again, to topple Hamas and to uproot them. And the worst thing is that the Israelis also lost international support. The sympathy which was there at the beginning of the conflict, when, just after the attack on Israel, is not there anymore. Israel is very isolated internationally at the moment.
Who do you put the responsibility on for these intelligence, for these military, strategic and tactical failures, as well as the ensuing diplomatic failures? Where do you point the finger of blame there?
Oh, obviously, there was an intelligence failure, but there will always be intelligence failures. You know, we can remember Barbarossa, we can remember Pearl Harbor. In 1973, there was an Israeli intelligence failure. And there are many military failures, Israeli military failures there. But the person who is responsible strategically to what's happened there is Prime Minister Netanyahu. Because, first of all, he is responsible because he was there. He is the Prime Minister. But more importantly, his entire strategy has been to have Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu wanted Hamas in the Gaza Strip. He did not want them to disappear, because his idea was to have Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the PA Fatah on the West Bank, and then he could tell the world, look, the Palestinian camp is so divided that I cannot discuss a peace with them or any settlement. With whom should I speak, Hamas or the PA? And therefore, Netanyahu allowed, for example, money, funds, to go to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Qatar helped with that. They carried the suitcases with the money to give to Hamas. So Netanyahu is the number one responsible for that, because he was there and his entire strategy has failed.
In terms of the diplomatic picture, Israel is under a lot of pressure. Could you give some sense of how the Israeli society and also the Israeli high command is responding to that kind of pressure, that emotional pressure to first come to a ceasefire, then to negotiate a political solution, and also negotiate some sort of security solution for the Gaza Strip and presumably the West Bank?
The only solution to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, Israel and Hamas, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, is the political solution. There is no escape. The Israelis and the Palestinians will have to negotiate, will have to find a way to sort it out. Now, it is very difficult for both parties to do that. The Palestinians have nothing to offer. They can only offer promises. They can only say to the Israelis, we will leave, you know, we will not attack you in the future. We will not repeat what we've just done. The Israelis don't believe them. The Israelis, they got all the tangibles. They got the land, the West Bank, etc. And if you want, against human nature for the Israelis to give it to the other side, you know, under the West Bank, for example, there is a lot of water. There is a sea of water. The West Bank provides Israel with strategic depth and so on. So it is against human nature for them to give it to the Palestinians, who can give very little in return. And therefore, if you want the parties to negotiate a future political solution, you must, you, the international community, must put pressure on them so that they do it.
If we could talk a little bit about Palestinian identity, the many national minorities, the many enclaves in the world, many of them which were thrown up after the Second World War and in the various carve-ups and diplomatic compromises that states made with each other after the Second World War, it did create many minorities who found themselves either stateless, homeless, in other countries. The Palestinians are one of those minorities, and yet, I think in contrast to many of these other groups, they have shown an extraordinary resilience. And what explains that resilience? And how can Israel live with that? Because it doesn't seem to me like it's going away, and they have enormous emotional support in Western populations, as we've seen with the many protest movements. Sometimes feels like the public rhetoric on the part of some Israeli politicians seems to just wish that to me, what seems to be just a fact of the region, it just wants to wish it away.
Look, there is going to be a Palestinian state because most of them are now living on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinians have already they give up on 78% of old Palestine. All they are asking now is to have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and it is unlikely that they will give up on this idea. They recognize Israel's right to exist on 78% of old Palestine. All they are asking for is to have the state on 22% on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And this is supported by the international community. The conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is not a religious conflict. Of course, there are religious elements there and disagreements about, for example, Jerusalem, which is important for both sides. But basically, the conflict between them is a territorial, secular conflict. And the only solution to the conflict is two states, Palestine and Israel, living side by side. Israel on more or less 78% of old Palestine, and Palestine, or the new Palestine, on the remaining 22%. That's the future. That's what's going to happen in the future.
Well, I hope you're right there, Aaron. I think that's the kind of settlement that many of us would like to see. But I wonder, what would be the perspective of Hamas on that kind of deal? Can that kind of deal happen while Hamas is around? Can it happen while Hezbollah is there on the Israeli-Lebanese border? There looks like a lot of complications before we can get to that kind of settlement.
People said about the PLO that you cannot have peace with the PLO. But then in 1988, the PLO accepted resolution, UN resolution 242, which recognizes the right of Israel to live in peace. I believe that Hamas too will change. And in many ways, if you do have a two-state solution, it will weaken Hamas, because you're right. Hamas is, at the moment, not interested in the existence of the state of Israel. But if you offer a two-state solution, it, in many ways, kills the idea of Hamas. You see, the Israelis, the world, must offer the Palestinians some, you know, political horizon. You must give them something they will not want to lose. And the something you could offer them is a state. And if they are happy or relatively happy, it will moderate the conflict with the Israelis. If you see, even if you have a two-state solution, a Palestinian state, it will not stop the violence overnight, because there will always be unhappy people on both sides. But over time, if you offer the Palestinians something that they will want to keep, then you, this is the road for peace between the two parties.
And if we are to set out on that road, I presume that that will require the intervention, at least diplomatic, of outside powers. Who do you think are the powers that could be constructive in terms of taking Israel and Palestine on that road?
Obviously, the Americans will have to play a leading role in bringing Palestinians and Israelis together. But for the Palestinians, it is also important to have on the side Arab countries, Muslim countries. So Egypt, I believe, and Saudi Arabia too will have to play a leading role. So it is the Americans, number one, and then key Arab countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
And the Saudis certainly are far more prominent, or at least appear to be far more prominent in that type of role than they've been in the past.
Yes, well, you see, one of the reasons why Hamas attacked Israel in October was the fear that the Israelis and the Saudis mm-hmm. will get together and sign an agreement, maybe even peace agreement, which would mean that the Palestinians are, you know, at the bottom of the queue. The Hamas, in attacking Israel, try to disrupt the diplomatic achievements between Israel and the Saudis. And therefore, Saudi Arabia is really important. And the lesson from what happened is that you cannot forget about the Palestinian issue. If Israel and Saudi Arabia want to sign, say, a peace treaty, they will have to take into consideration the Palestinian issue.
Do you think the recent ICJ rulings, of which South Africa was the principal architect, aided by countries like Ireland, do you think that's been helpful, or could be helpful or harmful to such a process?
Well, it's not good for Israel. Israel is stained now and very much humiliated by what happened in Den Haag. The judges were very careful not to stop the Israelis from continuing the war, not to defend themselves, but they did issue tickets. The Israelis should report to them, and the Israelis should take measures to make sure that no genocide is done there. So it's not good for the Israeli reputation. I think that the Israelis will try to be more careful now, realizing that it is not approved by the international community. So, you see, I don't know if there is a genocide in the Gaza Strip. It is very difficult to prove that there is genocide because you should show an intention. But if we look at the Gaza Strip, it is clear that things are not right. There are too many innocent people killed, there are too many houses, too much destruction, and so on. So the bottom line, I think that what the judges said will be a warning to the Israelis, and I think that they will be more careful now.
We seem to be a long way, Aaron, from 50, 40 years ago. The perceptions of Israel as a plucky, courageous, small country pulling off brave and skillful military victories in the face of overwhelming opposition in the region, hostile powers. Israel is not seen like that in the West. It would be very hard to find someone who saw Israel in those terms, even in the aftermath of what happened in October, which in some ways revealed to me the reality of Israel's position in a region which is a tough environment. We feel very far away from those images of the Yom Kippur War, the conflict in 67. How do you think Israeli identity has evolved since then?
There are two histories. The history which started in 1948, a new history of Israel which started in 2023. The new Israel is very different. It's very different. The new Israel is an Israeli nation which lost much of its self-confidence. It's a nation which is very humiliated by what happened. But you know, maybe it's not so bad, because if we do want to have peace between Israel and the Palestinians, what you need is, and it's terrible to say that, what you need is two parties which are totally exhausted and tired, two parties that want to have a change. And maybe the terrible bloody nose that the Israelis got in October, maybe this will push them to try and compromise and to look for a new way. And maybe this, maybe, you know, in international relations, there is a term which we call ripeness, like the fruit which is ripe. So maybe there is more ripeness in Israel and on the Palestinian side too, and they are ready to move forward and to try and compromise.
You're right that for a political solution to happen, not just Palestinian identity has to shift, but also Israeli identity and Israeli preconceptions about Israel's place in the world.
It will be very interesting to see what kind of Israel emerges from this conflict, and from the attack on them on the in October. Because you see, what happened in October to the Israelis never happened before. In one single day, 1,200 Israelis were killed. Even in the diaspora, during the pogroms, the attacks on the Jews, we never witnessed so many casualties or so many dead people in one single day. Also, for the first time in Israel's history, part of its land was occupied by the enemy. And the enemy was not even a strong Egyptian army or Syrian army, but Palestinians. And not only that, the Palestinian Hamas managed to, you know, to control the occupied lands for 7, 8, 9 hours. And therefore, there is a big shock there. And the Israelis, in many ways, lost what we call in war studies, they lost their deterrence. Nobody is afraid, seems to be afraid anymore to attack them. Hezbollah is attacking them, you know, the Houthis attack them from Yemen, and so on and so forth. And this explains why the Israelis are trying to hit very hard at the enemy to restore their deterrence, to make the people around them, you know, to deter the people around them. But you cannot achieve deterrence only by military force. The Israelis must have the international community with them. And it seems that the strong military action in the Gaza Strip is counterproductive in terms of international support. Mm. So the Israelis do have a problem with their deterrence. And again, it will be very interesting to look at the new Israel that will emerge from this disaster.
It was shocking what we observed happening on the 7th of October in 2023. That was widespread. But just as shocking to me was the way in which, almost immediately, not as a counter to what Israel did afterwards, but almost immediately after those events happened, people were on the streets of London, of capitals in the West, supporting Hamas. We've had very large demonstrations in London, throughout Europe, in other parts of the world, that are not the Arab street, where we've seen virulent anti-Semitism, often masking itself in support of a Palestine state. We've had various slogans that have been used that can certainly be considered anti-Semitic, that all but call for the elimination of the state of Israel and perhaps as a consequence, all Jews. There has been a huge, visible rise in anti-Semitism on the streets of Europe and beyond. That seems to me to change the dynamic of any solution. We used to refer to the Arab street and the way that put Arab governments into a straitjacket in response to their own people. I didn't think we'd see that in the West, but it seems that perhaps, in part because of changing demographics, we're also seeing that here as well. And Israel seems to be in a much weaker diplomatic situation than it's been in the past with this rise in anti-Semitism. I mean, what's your take on that as someone who presumably has seen that take place in cities like London?
Yes, I could see it myself, you know, walking in the streets of London, seeing all these demonstrations. I don't think that the demonstrations were in support of Hamas. They were more in support of the Palestinians. Of course,
there were elements there.
Yeah. Of course, yes. There were elements supporting Hamas, elements supporting Daesh. You see, it is a lot to do with social media. Mm-hmm. Because everything is broadcasted immediately from the war zone, and people react to it. And yes, there is clear increase in anti-Semitism, and I hope that it will stop when the war comes to an end. The anti-Semitism is there bubbling under the ground in many parts of the world, and it increases when there are problems in the Middle East. But again, it is the social media that changed everything and bring so many people out to the streets of, you know, of London and other big cities. But yes, you're right. I witnessed this increase in anti-Semitism, and I was very concerned about it. I am very concerned about it.
On the issue of social media, I just wanted to ask you a question, as you are a former serving officer in the IDF. I've seen a number of Israeli soldiers taking part in active service in Gaza, making statements on iPhones, on Twitter, on Facebook, that seem to be, shall I say, somewhat ill-advised. I wonder if the IDF is losing some kind of discipline there, and whether things like the ruling at The Hague may force some of the Israeli commanders to say, come on, I think we should be rather more careful about some of the images and some of the points of view we're expressing in social media. There seem to be several loose cannons out there, shall we say.
The Israeli army is not a professional army. It is made of the Israeli people. Israel is what we call in war studies a nation in arms. Now, many of the troops operating in the Gaza Strip, especially in the infantry, they are settlers. You can see that they come from Judea and Samaria, which is the West Bank, and they regard the Gaza Strip, where the war is ongoing, as part of Eretz Israel, which is the land of Israel. They believe that the Gaza Strip and the Judea and Samaria belongs to the Jewish people. Therefore, you can see short clips sent by them and taken on their iPhones in which they say things about the Gaza Strip, which reflects their beliefs about the Gaza Strip, that it should go to Israel and that all the Palestinians should leave the Gaza Strip. I believe that one of the lessons of war will be that soldiers are not allowed or should not have their iPhones in their pockets, because the messages they sent from the war zone cause a massive damage to Israel.
Aaron, you were the academic consultant on a series produced by the filmmaker Norma Percy, The 50 Years War, Israel and the Arabs, which is available, I think, on iPlayer. You would have met many of the figures on both sides of the conflict, experienced them up close. Do you get, you know, contacts from significant figures on the Palestinian side, people who contact you? And what are your memories of the making of that series, which charted the whole short history of modern Israel and the history of the conflict? Do you think it would be possible to make such a series now, with the personalities involved? What were your hopes at the time of the making of that? Because it felt like a different period. I think it was made in the late 90s, and 2000s, when there was much more discussion about peace process. What are your recollections of the making of that?
In fact, I was involved in the making of two BBC series. The first one was the 50 Years War, and the second one was called Elusive Peace. And it was mainly about the peace process. And one of the most interesting people I interviewed for Elusive Peace was Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Now, one of the things we covered in Elusive Peace was the decision by Sharon, Prime Minister of Israel, to withdraw from the Gaza Strip. We talked about it in the program. He led Israel out of the Gaza Strip in 2005. And when I interviewed him, I remember thinking to myself, oh, this is really the beginning of peace between Israel and the Palestinians, because Sharon's plan was to get out of the Gaza Strip and also to get out from most of the West Bank and to do a two-state solution. I think that if I will be invited to be a consultant on a new series about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it will be unfortunately about the going back into the Gaza Strip, which is very depressing.
Doesn't that give you some hope that Ariel Sharon, who was in many ways a very uncompromising figure, someone who fought for his country, who was in his public statements about Israel's status incredibly strong-willed, that he was able to withdraw from the Gaza Strip, that he was able to sell that to the Israeli public and carry it out, does that give you some hope that even the more hard-line elements of Israeli politics can find some accommodation with the kind of projects you talked about earlier in the podcast, that normalisation, that two-state political solution that recognises a Palestinian state?
Ariel Sharon, of course, fought in all of Israel's wars from 1948, 1956, 1967, of course, the 1973 Yom Kippur War. And he, after all these wars, he realized that it is time to adopt a new direction. Unfortunately, he died while trying to do that. He had a stroke and he died. We will need a future a leader as strong as Ariel Sharon to do peace between Israel and Palestinians. But the future leader, I believe, will have to come from the right, not from the left of the Israeli political spectrum. Because if a right-wing Israeli leader say, let's do a two-state solution, the left will always support him or her. But if the left in Israel tries to make peace or two-state solution, the right-wing political parties will always be against it. So the future Israeli leader who will lead Israel to two-state solution, I believe, will have to come from the center or center-right of the political spectrum in Israel.
It's rather like the way that in the UK, serious radical reform of the NHS could only probably come from the Labour Party. I suppose it's rather like that situation. You've been quite optimistic considering the situation in Israel and Gaza as it is today. You've been surprisingly optimistic about a route out of this abyss. I presume that if we are to start out on that road, there is one person who's got to go, and that's Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think it is likely that soon the Israeli electorate will be able to get rid of him and will be inclined to do so? And if so, is there any name you could put forward who could perhaps set us on that path to some kind of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians?
Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, wants the war to continue because he understands that when the war comes to an end, there will be massive demonstrations in Israel against his government, against him, asking for him to go. I cannot see a Churchill or Eric Sharon in Israel at the moment, but that's the situation. The only leader who could lead Israel and enjoy some good support in Israel is a former general, a former chief of staff by the name of Benny Gantz.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Let us hope such a figure emerges, whether it's Gantz or anyone else, because Israel, Palestine, the world needs such figures. Thank you very much for your insights, remarkable insights on the current situation in Israel and Gaza. Aaron, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.